Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You are listening to the Mother of All Talk Shows podcast with George Galloway.
As I was coming into the studio, the news broke that Syrian mercenaries were speeding to the front in Nagorno-Karabakh, transported there by the Turkish regime of Erdogan, transferred to Azerbaijan, who have announced that they are going to finish this Nagorno-Karabakh problem. A kind of final solution. And that would be appropriate because the last time a Turk talked about finishing anything to do with Armenians, it led to a genocide, second only to the Holocaust, just some years later in the run-up to and throughout the Second World War. A final solution implemented by the Syrian head-chopping, throat-slitting, game-murdering, heart-eating, women-hating, freedom fighters that we have been supporting for a decade in Syria. Bitter, moi, extremely bitter. Not just bitter about what the head choppers have been doing in Syria. Against Christians, against other Muslims, against other Sunni Muslims who didn't accept the narrow interpretation of Islam of the Salafist fronts affiliated with Al-Qaeda and with ISIS. I'm angry about that, but I'm equally angry that we paid for it. I was one of the voices in the Houses of Parliament behind me that warned and warned and warned again that the Frankenstein monsters that we were supporting in Syria would one day spill out, cascade across our own streets, which they did in Paris and in London, allegedly on the very same day this week. You can't pick and choose, you see, which monsters you support and which you're going to crack down on in your own country, because these monsters recognize no borders. And the stronger you make them over there, the more dangerous they will be when they come over here. And they're here in our midst. A brave police sergeant, unarmed, shot dead in a Croydon police station, inside the custody suite of a Croydon police station this week. Four innocent passers-by just walking in the 11th arrondissement in Paris, which had the misfortune some years ago of being the place where the Charlie Hebdo magazine was based, were macheted, their throats cut, their heads almost severed from their shoulders. They haven't gone away, you know, are these fanatic extremists. And now they are on the front line between Azerbaijan and Armenia, which will inevitably, as it did in Syria, draw Russia into the fight. Indeed, that may be the very point. The Turco-Russian war in Syria just got transported into the borderlands between Azerbaijan and Armenia. But of course, it's the crimes committed by these very mercenaries in Syria that will provide the first part of this show this evening. because earlier this week, I received a document dump at an address I don't publicize from the group calling itself Anonymous. That document dump was voluminous, to say the least. I didn't have time to carefully study it all, so I sent it to my friends through the glass, saying this is important enough to lead the show on Sunday. But little did I know that all the devils in the detail would be filleted and packaged brilliantly by the estimable Grey Zone Project and one of our favourite correspondents of all time, young Ben Norton. He distilled this gigantic Anonymous document dump into the most startling revelation you could possibly imagine. You see, you may have wondered how these cutthroats, head choppers, heart eaters could possibly have got such a fair press in Britain and in the West. And the answer is because you paid for it. Not that you knew it, of course. You paid for it secretly. The British government, using your money, secretly funded an entire public relations industry, providing a blizzard of white helmets and fake chemical weapons attacks and all the paraphernalia of the newly moderate Syrian opposition. You paid for all of that. You built up an entire industry of fake news about Syria. Now, most of us knew it in our hearts. Most of us smelt a rat over Douma. Most of us smelt a rat over the work of the white helmets as they climbed all the way up to the Oscars, thanking their mothers and their sisters, thanking everyone except those that helped them the most. You, the British taxpayer, spent scores of millions, maybe more than 100 million. Imagine, in this cash-strapped, COVID-stricken country, we may have spent £100 million of British taxpayers' money on fake news propaganda for the affiliates of Al-Qaeda and ISIS, whilst hunting them in Croydon, whilst hunting them in Paris. We were paying for them in Syria. If that doesn't make you mad, you must already be dead, which is exactly what ISIS and Al-Qaeda would prefer that you were. Thanks to Anonymous, and thanks to Ben Norton and the Grey Zone, we've got the names, we've got the pack drill, we've got the check numbers, we've got the numbers in the check box. We know who was being paid what out of our money to pay for propaganda that almost over Douma took the whole world to war. Don't forget that. The fake chemical weapon attack almost brought World War III. Almost caused a superpower conflagration between Russia, the United States of America, and its foolish or knavish allies, Britain and France, principally amongst them. I often say, as a joke, you couldn't make it up. You couldn't make this up. But they made it up. They made all of it up. And thanks to these documents from Anonymous and Ben Norton's analysis of those documents, we've got the receipts. We've got the chapter and verse. And we're going to talk to Ben Norton in the first hour on this subject. It's not just that they fooled you over Syria. I have apparently sane, grown men calling this show and talking to me about concentration camps in China. In the media, claims of 1 million Uyghurs in concentration camps. It's all from the same people. It's all from the people who told you that Iraq was bristling with nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The same people who lied to you over Syria are lying to you about China, lying to you about Russia, and they'll be lying tomorrow about Armenia. I have no doubt at all about that. And even when it's abundantly obvious that each lie turns into disaster, not just exposed as a lie, but as an actual boomerang that rebounds against our national interest and the safety of our people, our so-called media leads us over and over and over again into the same kind of morass. And we're still in a mess over the coronavirus, aren't we? We now have Glasgow as the worst affected area in Britain. We're now told that the Scottish parliamentary elections, which should have been held last May, may now have to be postponed again from next May. Well, I tell you now, if that's the case, then the separatist, secessionist government of Nicola Sturgeon must be replaced by a government of national unity. We cannot allow a government to stay in power, a minority government, to stay in power year after year as elections are postponed and postponed. And if that does not happen, then direct rule from Westminster will have to be reimposed. Better, Ms. Sturgeon, that you bring the Conservatives, Labour and the Liberal Democrats into the government. A government of national unity to combat this crisis, both health and economic, that is afflicting the people of Scotland so severely. Now, the coronavirus, which has cut a swathe through our people for the great majority of this year, will be in the third hour. And we'll be asking if the same police force that presided over the fiasco in the Croydon police station, where a man in handcuffs in a custody suite is able to murder a police officer, presumably shooting through his legs at the police officer's chest, didn't go far, far too far in Trafalgar Square yesterday. 10, 15,000, many of them nutters, COVID deniers, David Icke types, but many of them ordinary British citizens exercising what they believed to be their rights of peaceful protest in the crucible of public protest in Britain, in Trafalgar Square, were set about by truncheon-wielding police officers, bowling them left and right, breaking their skulls. It didn't look good to me. It doesn't look good to me for Cressida Dick, the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. It's been a bad week for her. And it doesn't look good for the so-called mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, looking like a little boy lost as all these problems swirl around his head. We'll be talking about all of that in the final hour. But here's the first poll. Who is the least charismatic? A, Sir Keir Starmer. B, Joe Biden. C, a block of wood. That's a close one. Well done, lads. That's as close a contest as I have seen in a long time. Now, the public relations machine created by British and American taxpayers to lie to the world about Syria boasted that they were in contact, close contact, with 1,600 journalists and influencers. And I think I know most of them. I just have to glance at their work about Syria, and I can tell they've been in close contact with the lie machine revealed by Anonymous and by the great Ben Norton of the even greater Grey Zone Project, who joins us now live across the Atlantic. Ben, thank you very much. 1,600 journalists and influencers. I reckon I could name a good few hundred of those, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely, George. Thanks for that great introduction. I have to say that, unfortunately, these documents are not really a surprise. They're confirming what we've known for many years. But what's incredible about these documents that I went through and I wrote a report at the Gray Zone just showing some of the highlights of these hundreds of pages of documents. These are materials that were filed with the UK Foreign and Commonwealth Office. So it's largely focusing on the British angle, although many of these contractors that were included in the documents are contractors that work with other Western governments as well, including the United States, Denmark, the Netherlands, even the European Union and the United Nations. So this is very much an international propaganda initiative. And of course, like I said, it's not surprising to learn about this, but what is kind of shocking is the breadth, the scale of this propaganda campaign. You mentioned that one of the firms called IncoStrat, which is a Western government contractor, boasted that it was in constant contact with over 1,600 journalists and influencers focusing on Syria. We also know that more than half of the stringers, so stringers are journalists on the ground who are kind of freelancers who provide video content to international media. More than half of the stringers on the ground in Syria that were used regularly by Al Jazeera were trained by these British government contractors. They took credit for training hundreds of media activists inside Syria. And when I say media activists, we should keep in mind, these are not impartial journalists who are being trained. These are people who are being trained in information warfare, because these Western governments understood that if they had Syrians on the ground, if they gave them the equipment, the training, the materials, and then help them get those the materials they recorded into Western media platforms, they could propagandize the world. They're not trying to provide a balanced, nuanced take on what's happening in Syria. This is propaganda, nonstop, demonizing the Syrian government and saying very little about what the actual conditions were on the ground in the territory controlled by these so-called rebels. Of course, what these journalists, these so-called journalists, these media activists, what they didn't mention in their reports is the ethnic cleansing of ethnic and religious minorities, is the horrific conditions that women were put into. And in the case of some women were enslaved and turned into prostitutes and sex trafficked. So, I mean, what's incredible about this propaganda is how extremely one-sided it was. And if you look at the documents, they say very clearly that these Western government initiatives that they launched were training these activists in order to do that. It's just all out in the open. It's absolutely incredible.
Well, we'll come back to why it was put into the open, which is a story in itself. But let me get this right. Countries like Denmark, the Netherlands, achingly politically correct, gender sensitive, sexual orientation sensitive, were paying for propaganda for areas controlled by these rebels where gay people were thrown off the roof and videoed being so done, where women were being stoned and murdered after mere accusations of adultery, where women were not just enslaved and sex trafficked, but even the women who were not so physically harmed became prisoners in their own houses, in their own all-enveloping black clothes. All these right-on liberals were paying these activists to snow job the people who were responsible for all these crimes. That's breathtaking, isn't it?
Absolutely, George. And I commented in my article, my report on these documents. There was one moment that was absolutely breathtaking, just jaw-dropping in the hypocrisy. Two of the main firms that we're talking about here that were working with the British government and other Western governments to push this propaganda initiative in Syria are called ARK, A-R-K, and the other one is called the Global Strategy Network, TGSN. Now, TGSN, by the way, keep in mind, was founded by the former head of counterterrorism for MI6. So this is an MI6 cutout. And in their documents, they were talking about how these firms they were actually directly running so-called rebel media operations. They created their own so-called rebel media platforms that were run by Western government cutouts. I mean, so the attempt to portray this as some kind of grassroots movement is laughable. But one of the documents they have, I'll read a quote from it here. It's absolutely incredible. It's their document to make sure that they, quote, follow UK guidance on gender sensitivity. So the firms that signed this are called ARK and TGSN. These were also the firms that were running the civil infrastructure and the social media for Idlib. Idlib is still right now controlled by al-Qaeda. It's the rebranded form of Syria's al-Qaeda affiliate, Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the largest al-Qaeda affiliate since the 9/11 attacks. It's absolutely massive, tens of thousands of extremist hardened fighters. And inside Idlib, women were executed publicly. In the public, they were shot in the head because they were accused of adultery. There's videos of this online. Meanwhile, this British government and U.S. government contractor, ARK, was running Idlib City Council's Facebook page and providing other services to ARK. And at the same time, it signed a deal with the U.K. Foreign Office on gender sensitivity and declared that, quote, it will ensure gender is considered in all capacity building and campaign development. I mean, it's absolutely dystopian. You can't make up something this hypocritical.
No, you couldn't make it up. And also in your splendid report, which I really urge everyone to read, in fact, it's mandatory to attend the Mother of All Talk Shows Open University, that you read this article later this evening after the show. It also is revealed that the British and other government advice to these activists was to create the events that they could then report on. They're very punctilious about it. Don't wait for events to happen. Create the events, then report them. This is entirely secular. It's more than public relations because we know what kind of events these were.
That's absolutely right, George. In the documents themselves, these firms boast that we have to create our own events. And as two examples of that, they provide this campaign to try to lift the Syrian government's siege on the city of Homs, which was controlled by these extremist Salafi jihadists that were ethnically cleansing Shia Muslims and put Alawite women and all Alawites from the Muslim minority in prison just because they were the wrong religion. So they took credit for successfully lifting that siege and effectively helping these hardline Salafi jihadist extremists. And then something else that they took credit for is helping to push out this absurd narrative that the secular Syrian government that maintains equal rights for all religious minorities is equal to ISIS. Is the other side of ISIS. And they created this Western government contractor, printed hundreds of thousands of propaganda materials and distributed them throughout Syria. They also worked with a host of Western corporate media outlets, including the BBC, Channel 4, The Guardian, The Times, The New York Times, The Washington Post. They worked with all of these firms, these firms worked with all of these Western corporate media outlets to spread this absurd conspiracy theory, trying to liken the secular Syrian government to ISIS. And we see how effective that disinformation campaign Right. was, because you still hear things like that today. It's absolutely incredible. And we need to keep in mind, again, that when we're talking about these firms, these are Western government intelligence cutouts. So it's not hyperbole to say that the propaganda that we were force-fed in the Western media came directly from the mouths and the minds of Western government intelligence operations.
Yes, men with suits and probably ties, probably based not a few meters from where I'm sitting now, and just across the river and throughout Whitehall and in Westminster, men who take the 623 back to some rural idyll outside London and play with their families, were responsible for a public relations machine of immense power and no sliver of conscience would appear to have flickered across their minds, because we only know this because Anonymous dumped this on us, and because you have the skill and industry to go through enormous amounts of data and bring it to us in the form that you have. We would never have known any of this. We would have suspected.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's R-E-B-A-G.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ben, you're right. But we could never have proved it. Now we know who these people are and how much they were being paid.
That's absolutely right. And when we're talking about how much they were being paid, we're talking about many millions of British pounds. And keep in mind, of course, this is British taxpayer money that is going to effectively subsidize what are Salafi jihadists. I would also invite people to check out, surprisingly, BBC for once did a pretty good documentary on this, BBC Panorama, a few years ago, toward the end of the war, of course, in 2017, they published a documentary called The Jihadis You Fund. And it was about how many of these British government contractors were supporting the civil infrastructure in areas controlled by al-Qaeda, by Jabhat al-Nusra. It was shocking at the time for much of the British public, but it was something that many of us independent journalists have been saying. And it's something that is still really going on right now inside Idlib with very little attention. But there was one other point that I wanted to stress here, and that's that we're talking about tens of millions of dollars, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars, tens of millions of British pounds, perhaps hundreds of millions of British pounds that were being spent on these propaganda operations. What also interests me is I think this is just scratching the surface. These are just some documents. The documents appear to have come from either someone in the British Foreign Office who had access to these documents, or they seem to come from people who were involved in these NGO circles who were working with a lot of these contractors. But this is just scratching the surface. This is just talking about one particular aspect of UK Foreign Office contractors. I want to know about what MI6 was doing, what the CIA was doing, what Turkish MIT was doing. There are so many other scandals that need to be uncovered. I think this is just a small percentage of what is, frankly, one of the largest propaganda operations ever constructed in human history. And for over 9 years, this propaganda has been constantly bombarded, has been broadcast into our brain, 24/7 nonstop. And it's really incredible because these so-called Western democracies from Britain, the United States, other European countries, they claim they have laws that ban intelligence agencies from using propaganda operations against their own domestic population. But what actually was happening here is that we, as taxpayers in the so-called West and in these so-called democracies, we were the targets of a massive psychological warfare campaign by our own governments. It's absolutely incredible.
Yes, in a normal country, this would be big news, and there would be a serious problem for the government in Westminster and in Washington. But of course, so corrupted has the so-called mainstream media become that this story and this discussion we're going to have now will be completely and utterly ignored by the political class and their media echo chamber. I'm right, haven't I?
Unfortunately, George, you're absolutely right. We've seen on Syria especially the kind of conformity in the media that people talk about in North Korea. You know, we're supposed to believe that all of these other evil boogeymen, they brainwash their populations. But the complete uniformity of Western so-called journalists, these stenographers who just march in lockstep with whatever their governments say on Syria or on Belarus or in Venezuela, I mean, it would make even authoritarian dictators blush. That they would say that that's for them, that's too blatant. So, and the fact that these stories are just totally ignored, it's not just Syria. How many stories right now? Julian Assange is being tortured, put through a show trial, and as you've covered, George, it's been totally ignored by the yes. Western media.
Yes,
it's absolutely. And meanwhile, the Washington Post, which is owned by the richest man on earth, Jeff Bezos. The slogan of the Washington Post has been, democracy dies in darkness. Well, democracy is dying in broad daylight, and they're not reporting on it.
That brings me to my last question, and I'm grateful, as always, for your time. We suspected this. Now we know it. It is inconceivable that the same kind of operations are not now being used against China on the Navalny case, against Russia, on the Belarus case, who knows, tomorrow perhaps against Armenia or against any stand that the Russian government might take in relation to Nagorno-Karabakh. These operations just roll on and roll on, surely.
That's absolutely right. And it just goes back, of course, hundreds of years, but especially if you know, I'm more familiar with the U.S. model of propaganda. And you can go back, of course, to looking at the Gulf of Tonkin incident with the Vietnam War, where the U.S. lied and claimed the North Vietnamese were attacking it to justify invading Vietnam. And then you can look at the first Iraq war with the Naira testimony and supposedly Iraqi soldiers were taking Kuwaiti babies out of incubators and leaving them to die. And then you look at the WMD's lies and the lies used to sell the war in Libya. Supposedly Muammar Gaddafi was giving Viagra to his soldiers and encouraging them to rape women. There's constant disinformation campaigns. These are lies that are used not just against captive populations in other countries, but against us ourselves, the taxpayers. And unfortunately, it just continues. And we saw with the second Iraq war and the WMD lies, no one was held to account. In fact, not only were no so-called journalists held accountable, they were rewarded. Many of the same Iraq war boosters who willingly just spread CIA lies claiming that we were threatened by Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. They're still writing for the New York Times. They're still writing for the Guardian. And they're the same people who are now reporting on Belarus, on China, on Russia, on Venezuela. So it just, all of this shows is that these Western media outlets that claim to be defending democracy, that claim to be providing information, unfortunately, the reality is that they're just propaganda arms of the government, and it's up to us to create our own independent media. And that's why I'm grateful for your show, George. That's why we created The Gray Zone, and you can check out our reporting at thegrayzone.com. And we're going to continue shining the light on these these journalistic abuses, because they're not providing news. They're actually mishandling the media.
Ben Norton, you're a star. Shine on. And regards to all of your friends at the Grey Zone. May God strengthen you. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Who is the least charismatic? Sir Keir Starmer, 51%, quite a commanding lead. Joe Biden, 27%. A block of wood is a decent third at 22%. You can vote on my Twitter feed. Now, Max Keiser is a clan chief in Scotland. He has an ancestral home. I'm trying to get his castle back, not least because there's actually a vacancy for the chief of the Galloway clan. And as I'm now living in Galloway, and I'm possibly the best known Galloway anywhere, I'm running for that office as clan chief, so that me and Max can form a new clan front in the south of Scotland. Even though we disagree on much, he is just irreplaceable, unrepeatable. They threw away the mould when they made Max Keiser, who joins me now. Max, how wonderful. Tell me, how's my investment doing? You told me to get into Bitcoin at under $10. What is it standing at now?
Oh, George, you know, it's around $10,000 now. And, you know, a lot of people we told about Bitcoin at $10. And, you know, thank God now I've got all the capital I need to take back my castle, Caverlock Castle, as part of the being the new chief of the Maxwell clan. And, you know, we're all about Reveresco. That's the motto of the Maxwell clan, Reveresco. We will rise again. You know, we've been doing battle with England for hundreds of years, George, and we're going to win this time.
Now, we'll come back to our clan future. You're sitting now, and we miss you terribly, in the United States of America, which seems to have gone berserk. Cities are burning. Two scarcely alive, or one scarcely sentient and the other scarcely alive, are doing battle for the US presidency. Your unemployment rate is rapidly reaching the levels of the 1930s. Depression, what on earth is going to happen in the United States?
Right. Well, you have, you know, I cover two major threads, really, George. I mean, I cover mostly economics. And as you know, we've been covering Bitcoin now for almost 10 years, and we see Bitcoin being adopted all over the world in places like Iran and Venezuela, and it's transforming the global economy. And I think that's a huge story, and it's just getting bigger every day. Here in the United States, we have a meltdown on the left-wing political side of the spectrum. Hillary Clinton, she never accepted her loss in 2016, and she's poisoned the political environment completely since then. And as a result, they don't really have a viable candidate in 2020. Trump looks like he's, you know, the guy who's going to win this election. And, you know, this is heading right into some major economic developments, and COVID-19 and all these things are happening. But I think to describe the political climate, you know, to give it encapsulate what's going on here, is that the Democrats wasted 4 years chasing the Russiagate hoax, which has now been proven to be a hoax, and they're going into this election underarmed, you know, without much really behind them. And they really blew it. They spent all their political capital on that Russiagate hoax, and now it looks like they're not really going to do much in this election either, George.
Now, the debate's coming up between the gorilla, Donald Trump, and the almost corpse-like Joe Biden. That must be ex-certificate, surely. You mustn't let children watch that one.
Well, in the case of Joe Biden, I really feel this might be becoming a case of elder abuse. Many of us who have had parents who start to lose their cognitive abilities, it's they need care and they need love and they need help and they need medical attention. But to put somebody like this who looks like they're having cognitive problems and it's rapidly getting worse. And this is also very symptomatic of that issue, is that once it starts to go downhill, it picks up pace and it becomes quite a problem. And to put him out there like a punching bag, really, and he doesn't even know where he is sometimes, that's abusive. And I don't know what the Democrats, it's not a good look for the Democrats. They don't have any compassion at all for this poor guy. He really needs medical attention.
Unless, of course, it's all a plan to replace him at the last minute with Harris or maybe even Clinton. Is that a possibility? Is that a conspiracy theory too far?
Well, given his health conditions, I think that's an open question and it's a good question. But, you know, again, just to stick on this point of being elder abuse, you know, he has served in Washington for decades and he should go out on more honorably than this, being used as a freak show. You know, it's almost like dragging the elephant man out during a freak show and everyone, you know, gawking and laughing. And it's very, very sad. As far as doing a last-minute replacement with Clinton or, you know, Kamala Harris, seems she's teed up to be ready to step in. They're playing. Okay, let's the game that out a little bit. And the Democrats have shown remarkable inability to outgame Donald Trump. You know, Donald Trump is somebody that is always one or two steps ahead of the Democrats. I'm sure the Republicans and Donald Trump have already worked through every possible scenario that the Democrats are going to throw at him, and he's got a response. As Trump said when he became president, he's a counterpuncher, right? He's a counterpuncher. He strategizes, he waits for you to make a move, and then he punches. And he's got thousands of lawyers set up all over the country, ready for this election. He's got the bully pulpit of the presidency in the White House. He uses it very, very effectively. He's brilliant on television. He's got brilliant marketing. He's got some legislative wins that he can point to. And so, again, I don't, whatever the dirty tricks the Democrats are planning, I think they're going up against a guy who's seen it all for decades.
Well, he's also got some of the most gun-crazed people in America in his base. It's I think, a hypothesis worth exploring. If Joe Biden or the Democrats were to defeat Donald Trump, he's already made it clear this week that he can't guarantee that he'll go peacefully from the White House, not least because they may well come after him legally. He might be the next victim of a Mueller-type inquiry. Is it possible that this could snarl up so badly with the mail voting, with the vote on the day being heavily Trump because the Republicans are voting in person, but then as the postal votes begin to get counted and contested, the Democrats themselves claiming victory? Could this become a shooting war, Max?
Well, I think let's unpack that a little bit. You know, you're covering a lot of ground there. So first of all, I think this election obviously is going to be highly contentious. Okay, that's a given. Number two, I think that the next day after the election, we won't have a clear winner. There will be, as you say, postal votes have got to come in, and it will be contested in many states. And we've seen that already several times. Remember the hanging chads when George W. won his election against Al Gore. It was contested, and it went to the Supreme Court. And I think that's why the Supreme Court nomination announced this week, and they're going to get that. It looks like they're going to have a vote on that before the election. This is very important because the election election will go to the results look like there's a probability that they will go to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court will make a decision. As far as then, will we have some sort of coup attempt, I guess you could call it. And on one hand, you could say, you know what, that sounds a bit outlandish. But then again, George, in 2016, when Trump was sworn into office, we now know, it's been fully documented and researched, that the Obama team and the Clinton team attempted a coup in America of Trump in 2016. And they set up Flynn in a way that we now know was completely bogus. They hired Steele in the UK to put out the Steele dossier, which was completely bogus. And they pulled out all the dirty tricks and they attempted a coup in 2016. So will the Democrats attempt a coup in 2021? Well, they've already done it in 2016. So I'd have to say that they've shown their colors. We know that they're capable of doing it. On the other hand, if the Supreme Court comes down and says that Trump lost, I'm sure Trump will follow his constitutional mandate and make way for the next administration.
Let's talk about the economy, which is your main field of endeavor. Am I right in saying that the United States is now facing sweeping unemployment, sweeping evictions of people who can't pay the rent, the landlords having to evict them, having to take action because the banks to whom they are in hock are closing in on them for repayment of their loans? How precarious is the U.S. economy right now?
It's about 10 to 20 times worse than we saw in 2008, right? So in 2008, when you had the global financial crisis, which was caused by the banks on Wall Street by over-leveraging the economy until it snapped and it broke, we said that you needed reform. You needed to rein these banks in. You needed to put some bankers in jail because they were committing massive fraud. But instead, what we heard from Obama and Eric Holder was his doctrine where banks are too big to prosecute. Bankers are strategic elements of the economy, and we can't put them in jail. And they expanded their credit line 10 to 20 times. And the banks did exactly the same thing now for the last 12 years that they did that led up to the 2008 crash. And now we've got the 2020 crash, which was very predictable. I said on my show, I said within 10 to 12 years, you'll have a repeat, but it'll be a lot worse. So did a few other folks out there who follow what's happening in the global economy. But and to give you an idea of some of the numbers here, if you remember back in 2008, the subprime market for housing was one of the major causes of that crash. And that was, let's call it a $1 trillion industry that blew up overnight, and that caused ripple effects. Well, right now, we find out that the commercial real estate market, which is a $17 trillion market, a third to 40% they're in arrears. And that looks like a $5 trillion or more collapse that's unfolding in real time before our eyes. So that obviously means that most banks and insurance companies in America are technically insolvent. But this is also true around the world. It's also true in the UK. What the U.S. has that nobody else has in the world is they still are the world reserve currency, the U.S. dollar, and the Federal Reserve Bank has the ability to print money. And they've been printing money by the trillion every week and every month. They've printed tens of trillions of dollars to keep these institutions afloat like they did in 2008, but they've done it now on a much grander scale. So the question, therefore, is, who's going to be the big loser on this new global financial crisis part two from what we saw in 2008? The U.S., because they do have that money printer and they do run, they still have a global empire of debt that's managed through Washington and Wall Street. They still have the ability to print themselves a lot of money here in the U.S. Other countries we see are strangled to death from liquidity. So obviously you see Venezuela, that whole area of the country, of the world, is starving of cash. Argentina, they're entering hyperinflation because their economies are so dire. We see problems in Iran. We see problems also in China. China is facing huge credit problems and credit collapse. So it's a question of the cleanest shirt in the laundry, right? The cleanest shirt in the laundry is still the United States in a very dirty basket of laundry. In the UK, you know, it looks pretty bad because you've got COVID, you've got GDP down sharply. And, of course, Brexit is still not resolved, and it looks like a no-deal Brexit, which is problematic for the economy. And I've always said with the Brexit that it would cause economic hardship. And the response I always got back from the British people that I know and talk to, the response was always that we value our sovereignty more than we do our financial well-being, and we're willing to take a financial hit for our sovereignty, as that term was being used. And so now you're gonna experience it. You're gonna experience a Brexit-related financial hit with the COVID hit combined, and it's gonna be very challenging. But you will have a different political situation to wave the flag. And we'll see how that works out,
well,
George.
Yeah, I'm not much into flags, as you know. But let's, before we leave the US dollar, the cleanest shirt in a dirty basket of laundry, there must come a point, mustn't there, when the fundamentals of the US economy, its level of indebtedness, begin to lose the affection or addiction to the dollar as a world reserve currency amongst the rest of the world. China and Russia are increasingly trading with each other in their own local currencies. Iran is trading with China in its own local currency. Moves are being made to set up a parallel SWIFT system for international transactions which don't include the dollar. Is the dollar going to be the king forever?
I would say the short answer would be no. And you're absolutely right that the rest of the world is de-dollarizing, and they are doing bilateral trades in their own currencies, bypassing the dollar. And if you look at the markets, you know, they do give you a clue what's going on. So the US dollar itself has been trading down more or less, but in the last couple of weeks, when more political crises are erupting, you see the dollar trade up. So that shows you that people around the world, their reflex is to buy dollars during crisis. And that's been with us since World War II. So they talk, a lot of people talk a big game, but when you have a crisis, people go to the most liquid, biggest, traded currency in the world, the US dollar. And you see that reflected in the price. The price of the dollar goes up. Now, I would look a little bit deeper to get a broader sense of what the bigger trends are. And so for that, you just have to look at the price of gold and look at price of gold in all various currencies. So gold has made new highs against all currencies starting more than 2 years ago. And it just made a new all-time high against the dollar within the past 6 months to a year. So that tells you that the big guns are positioning themselves in gold out of the dollar, because the dollar and the gold are mutually exclusive. They trade opposite of each other. Additionally, and this is where Bitcoin comes in, many people who buy gold are now equating gold with Bitcoin, and they are buying Bitcoin. So you have Paul Tudor Jones, who's a major hedge fund guy in America. I've followed his career for decades. He's been buying Bitcoin. He says it's superior to gold. It's the fastest horse in the race. You have a big company here in America called MicroStrategy, run by a guy named Michael Saylor, who just put almost $500 million of the company's treasury out of cash, out of dollars, into Bitcoin. This is really a shot to start a boardroom revolution in America, where companies with huge cash positions start to diversify out of the dollar for the reasons you just said, and into something that protects them from the inflation and the money printing. And there's only two choices. There's gold and Bitcoin, and Bitcoin is an obvious superior choice in that situation, and that's where people are moving their capital. So corporations are moving that way. In the case of the sovereign level, we see countries like Iran come out and saying, we're actually going to start subsidized Bitcoin mining, and we're going to start building a position in Bitcoin as a way to work around the sanctions and to bolster our own economy, which is makes perfect sense for a country like that to want to be in a censorship-proof, unconfiscatable, hard money like Bitcoin. So the light bulb has gone off, and that's the direction that they're going. Same thing in Venezuela. They are tiptoeing their way into Bitcoin. They introduced their own currency, the Petro, which was kind of an interim step. There's some obvious limitations to that, and now they're heading into the primary of all, and that is Bitcoin. There's several countries now. Belarus is actually involved to some degree. All these countries that are on the periphery of the American empire that are essentially falling out of the empire, the influence of the empire, they realize that to truly divest themselves from the dollar, they need their own hard currency. And that means that it cannot be a fiat currency. It has to be hard money. There's only two choices, gold and Bitcoin. And Bitcoin is emerging really as the go-to hard money for corporations, sovereigns, and individuals to protect themselves against all this money printing, George.
Finally, and I'm grateful for your time, Max, as always, what would be the tipping point? Would it be China moving into Bitcoin in a big way? Would that tip the balance against the dollar and against gold?
That would certainly tip the balance against the dollar. But I think it just, in the case of the dollar, it's a war of attrition. If you look at the total amount of trade in the world and what percentage of it is U.S. dollar based, it is gone from a post-war high of 80% or so down to under 60%. It's getting close to that magical 50% number. Once you go drop below 50%, it's an easy trade. You can easily say, hey, you know what? The dollar, it's no longer got a majority of global trade, and we've got to start taking actions. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. People start to protect themselves against the dollar. They start buying gold and Bitcoin. The price of gold and Bitcoin start moving up, which attracts more people to buy gold and Bitcoin. And where's the source of those funds? The dollar. So they're short dollar, long gold and Bitcoin. And once that self-feeding frenzy takes over, then everything happens pretty quickly. You know, people always ask me, when should I buy gold? When should I buy Bitcoin? You know, it's better to be a year early than a day too late.
Well, good advice. I'm glad I took it. The legend, Max Keiser of RT. 3 times a week, Max. Still, yeah?
Yeah, we're going very strong, and we're dubbed into Spanish, which is getting incredible attention. And also, we have got a new podcast called the Orange Pill Podcast that we do several times a week, and it's gaining a lot of attention, a lot of traction. People love it.
Fantastic. Check it out if you haven't. Max and his good lady, his good wife, Stacy, as a double act, they're even better than Max is on his own. Max Keiser, thank you for joining us. In the 2024 U.S. presidential elections, will it be Kamala Harris? Will it be Meghan Markle? You think I'm joking? She's not. Will it be Ivanka Trump? She's not joking either. Actually, all three of them have expressed a wish to become the President of the United States of America. If Joe Biden doesn't get replaced before the poll and the Democrats win, I reckon he'll last all of 6 weeks and Kamala Harris will be in the incumbency. Meghan Markle, she got the right stuff. She wears the right suits, if you'll forgive the pun. And if...
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ivanka. Now, she would be a powerful candidate for Donald Trump's base, don't you think? Ivanka Trump is in the lead at the moment. The poll closes at 9:50. Thank you, son. That's my lovely grandson who goes to the School of Oriental and African Studies in the morning. Good luck with that, son. Now, COVID info for today. You heard the news from Jamie Lowe. The big swing in the spike of new infections is taking place amongst young teenagers aged between 15 and 19. That's the people that the Labour Party and the Conservative Party insisted had to go back to school. That's the people, including Labour and the Conservatives, and especially the SNP in Scotland, insisted go back to university. No sooner had they arrived at the university, they were locked up in a cell, otherwise known as a student flat. Not permitted to leave, not permitted to go to a bar, not permitted to go to a restaurant, and above all, not permitted to go home to their parents to sit out the rest of the crisis. Big, big news this. A very big new factor. 5,693 new cases in the last 24 hours, which is down from 6,042. Although weekend reporting usually leads to an undercounting. And the number of deaths, of course, continues to increase too. 17 people died in Britain in the last 24 hours of the coronavirus. Let's see the doctor now without further delay. Dr. Ranjit Brar, NHS consultant, physician and surgeon, and all round. Good egg. Dr. Ranjit, thanks for joining us again. Let's talk first, please, about this new information. Wales, two-thirds of the population of Wales, now under more serious lockdown than elsewhere in the country. Glasgow, now the epicentre of this appalling sea of misery that we have around this issue in the country, not just from the virus, but the opportunity cost of the virus, people with other illnesses, other conditions which are not being treated, operations cancelled, people's mental health problems, problems of civil liberties. We saw in Trafalgar Square yesterday some very ugly scenes. In amongst all this misery, Glasgow, the epicentre, young people, the new front. What's your observation on these?
Thanks, George. Good to be back with you. As you say, it's a very worrying moment. What's quite clear is that the population of our country, as indeed much of the world, but particularly our country, is suffering from, if you like, coronavirus fatigue. It's a story we wish would go away. It's a story none of us want to really be involved with, but it's a fact that we have to contend with and confront, George. And it's quite clear, increasingly clear, that our government hasn't really contended with it and hasn't really confronted it and never really had a plan. That initial plan of herd immunity, protect the economy, and if a few pensioners die, so be it, of allowing the virus really to spread unchecked through the population, has indeed been the underlying theme throughout. You know, it was briefly interrupted by a sudden draconian about-face and lockdown. And really, that's put Boris Johnson at odds with himself, with his own usual ideology, with his party. And we've seen that even now we're getting totally mixed messages about whether really we should all go back to work, or now we should all work from home. One minute we should all go to school, the next minute everyone who goes back to university is on lockdown. And we know that Boris Johnson was actively considering a so-called circuit breaker of a new, perhaps 1 or 2 week over the half-term period, total lockdown throughout the country, and was opposed by the rest of his cabinet, and particularly Rishi Sunak. So there is no unified government position on this, and the Tories are being driven, despite themselves, against their own kind of libertarian instincts, just by the sheer pandemonium of which they're overseeing, due to their lack of adequate measures that they put in place. I mean, we don't need the vaccine to eradicate the virus. We've seen that in many countries, most notably China, where the virus was first identified, characterized, and that DNA code and testing was disseminated so transparently back in January, let's not forget. So now 8 months, there's no point quibbling about whether it could have been 1 or 2 weeks earlier, when we see that our own government have failed to put into place the very measures which could have got us back to normal. Wuhan, China are literally having sporting events, social events, music concerts to celebrate returning to normal, despite their high level of vigilance, meaning a large testing program. We see that in our government, in our country, the sixth richest nation on earth, we've not been able to scale up testing adequately, so that there's huge backlogs in testing. Testing's been put on a totally different system outside the NHS, such that when they finally launched the Test and Track app this week, there were grave concerns, of course, 5 months ago about its privacy. That app, we've been told, has been rejigged to encode and protect people's privacy. But nonetheless, there were major failings with the app, such that 13% of users couldn't actually download it to their phones in the first place. A huge number of people found they were unable to put in negative results into the app and therefore were told to isolate, even though they don't have the virus. People on the Welsh borders were finding that they were receiving information in Welsh. They couldn't understand the information. And so a huge number of problems. And of course, we know that probably less than 50% of people who have the virus are being adequately traced, and their contacts are being traced. And we know that less than 20% are able to actually self-isolate because of economic and other social pressures. So all of the public health measures, you know, which could have been put into place, which China disseminated throughout the world, showed worked, and other countries have been able to put into place. South Korea, of course, let's not forget, developed an app which met approval with their population. No reason why you can't have measures which meet approval with a population, with adequate communication and adequate dissemination of information, and a government which is trusted by its people. So that app was put in place within weeks of the viral outbreak, allowing people to see where were high in risk areas, what buildings were best to avoid because cases had been seen there. By contrast, there's been a totally laissez-faire approach. People have been very smug in our government about the declining number of cases. Then, of course, the famous eat out to help out, trying to get the relatively affluent to go back to restaurants, trying to get everyone to go back to schools and universities without really any adequate measures. So we've never really, throughout this pandemic, had sight of the virus. What we do have sight of is the figures of the numbers of cases. ONS are now saying probably close to 10,000 cases per day. The number of deaths last week was back towards just over the 200 mark, when it was down to, you know, single digits, certainly less than 100 for several weeks throughout August, when, of course, schools are out, universities were out, people were working from home. And of course, we know that poverty is rising as the economic crisis is worsening. Perhaps as many as 5 million people we're expecting by the end of the year to be essentially destitute, not able to afford food, clothing, housing and shelter. And of course, that will put them in a position where it's very hard for them to comply with restrictions. And increasingly, we're seeing a more draconian approach. And I think you're right. If you look at the demonstrations, people who are, you know, fed up, which you don't trust the government, who don't trust its measurement, who have lost faith with the government to the extent that they think the entire virus itself is a conspiracy, no worse than a common cold, which I'm afraid is not true, that they have lost faith with the government, and the government's response to them, rather than persuading them or helping them, is to beat them off the street, some of them quite elderly you know, grandmothers really being, the spectacle of them being beaten by the police certainly is not going to reduce the risk of the virus spreading, and it's certainly not going to increase the likelihood that the population will accept the government's leadership and comply meekly or comply with regulations which should be putting in place to protect our health, but which have manifestly not been adequately planned for, George.
I'm almost lost for words, actually, at the length of and the power of the indictment that you have just delivered. It's, our approach has been neither one thing nor the other. Am I right? It hasn't been South Korea and it hasn't been Sweden. It has veered between one and the other, according to the prevailing political winds. And we still don't know, really, whether we're headed in the one direction or the other.
I think that's right, George. It's been without any joined up thinking or planning. It's quite clear that the voices of reason have been arguing for public health measures. But of course, our very economic system, the way in which the prevailing policy of privatization and winding down a really comprehensive national health system in favor of a contracted out, subcontracted, privatized, you know, not just PFI, but hospitals, services being privatized. Richard Branson suing Cambridge Hospital for not awarding him the pediatric services contract that he wanted for an unknown figure is just one example of that. Richard Branson is the largest GP now in the NHS. He holds some 4 million GPs services for some 4 million patients. And, you know, the more you examine the NHS, the more you see it's broken down. It was remarkable to see that if you'd had a test for COVID in an NHS facility, and that included an NHS hospital, that included a Public Health England laboratory that still exists, they've not been quite wound down, and that included an ONS testing facility. So all the major governmental pillars of testing, if you'd had a test from one of those sources, you could not place that into the track and trace app launched by the government. Only one from the Lighthouse Laboratories, from the private sector, could be entered. So the level of disjointed thinking, and Baroness Harding, who's been put in charge of a track and trace, we've learned, you know, her main contact, of course, she was ennobled. She's an old a British peer from a British economic and military family, a very powerful family. She was a classmate of David Cameron and was ennobled by David Cameron. She's been further empowered by Boris Johnson under this administration and put in charge of a hugely important service with tens and perhaps hundreds of billions of pounds at her disposal for this one simple task of finding out who has the virus, scaling up our testing to adequately meet the need, sharing that information and planning accordingly. And there's abject failure to do so, and there's absolutely no accountability. These contracts are going out to companies like Serco. Serco, we know the CEO is Rupert Soames, brother of the MP, Nicholas Soames, who's much lauded for being the grandson of Winston Churchill. But these are the figures who, you know, we're used to the idea that when we invade foreign governments, much as we may not like it, Libya, we steal their sovereign wealth fund, Iraq, we steal their gold reserves. But it's kind of understood tacitly that we're going to those countries to steal their oil, but I don't think it's fully appreciated the extent to which when the Conservative administration and indeed other administrations, we can look at Blair and see the personal fortune he amassed, when they get into office, their sole mission is to empower their corporate acquaintances and friends to loot the British Treasury, not to serve the interests of the British people. I think that if you really look at this testing and tracing, if you look at the fact Dido Harding, Sir Simon Stevens, who is the chief executive of NHS England, but himself is someone who is appointee of large American health corporations and has been working them for 10 years, has come back with a mission to privatise the NHS, and indeed Matt Hancock. All of them are involved together in racing. They're all involved in the jockey club. They all have, you know, horse racing, an interest in horse racing. The way in which they socialise, the circles in which they socialise, the obvious ways in which their interests run counter to the interests of the general population. And that's highlighted really by the overall ethos and the back benches, the 1922 committee, most of the new crop of Tory MPs, again, are of this libertarian thinking. And they merge to a certain extent with a certain more anarchistic group of the left who just are totally against any kind of state controls. But for this Tory administration, they really feel their main aim is to put more and more wealth into the hands of their corporate cronies. And they really, are not planning and do not care about the overall general health of the population. So their occasional breakthrough of draconian measures and, police beating up crowds, or whether it's, a total lockdown for the country at the same time as huge intermittent bailouts for businesses, not for people, but for businesses, and the poorest of the workers who were anyway unemployed long term receive the least in terms of subsidy and support. We saw suddenly that the homeless disappeared from our streets during lockdown in March and April, but suddenly they're back again. I mean, this pandemic and this situation looks very different depending on your economic circumstances, George. And, it's really what we're seeing once again is that this pandemic is holding up a mirror to our society, which is revealing so much that is wrong and needs to be urgently corrected.
Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the ugliest of them all? I think you've got it in one. Thank you, Dr. Brar, as always, for that tour de force. Here's Martin in Oregon on Lee Harvey Oswald / JFK. Go ahead, Martin.
Hello, George. It's good to hear your voice and honored to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you. It's good of you to call. We're going to deal with this in depth on Moats Extra over the next few weeks. But go ahead. You've got a point of view.
I sure do. It sounded like earlier in the program you mentioned Lee Harvey Oswald as the assassin in Kennedy murder.
Yeah, I was quoting the Warren Commission, of course.
I see. Yes. Because a lot of people have problems with that Warren Commission report, and I was just going to mention, in case you were buying that line, that when Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, they did this paraffin test, which was meant to determine as to whether or not he had fired a weapon.
Yeah.
So when you fire a weapon, gunshot residue will be deposited on the person using the gun. And those paraffin tests showed that Lee Harvey Oswald did not fire a rifle on that day.
Yeah, I believe, as he said himself, he was a patsy.
Yeah, and I completely agree. And it sounds like, rather than my pushing back, it sounds like we're in alignment.
But we're on the same page, but we will go into it in some considerable depth, Martin, over the next couple of weeks once we start the Moats Extra, as we will be doing with 9/11, with the coronavirus, all these deeply controversial issues. We'll be doing in-depth programs on them. So stay tuned, stay alert, and join us.
Well, could I make a recommendation? If you haven't already contacted, there's a historian by the name of James Di Eugenio. He's collected quite a bit of information on this assassination topic, and he might be worth looking into.
I'm sure my friends have noted that, and definitely, if we can, we'll take you up on that suggestion, Martin, in Oregon. Thank you very much. From Oregon to Motherwell, of course, it's Derek on the UK government. Go ahead, Derek.
George, how are you?
Good. I'm glad to hear from you.
Not too bad. How many people, George, does it take to enter the centre of London before the government, who represent the citizens, pay heed to what we want and need? Give us a number, George.
Well, it will not be, need to be a lot more than 15,000.
But you had 1 million for the stop the war, and that wasn't enough.
We had 2 million, and it wasn't enough.
2 million.
And so the numbers themselves are not anywhere near that kind of level. The opinion polling actually is heavily weighted with people that want the government to go much further, not less far, on cracking down, locking up, locking down, and so on. So I think you're a long way from being a majority, which doesn't mean you're not right, Derek.
But if all the activists, George, for every major cause come together, united we stand, these opinion polls are made up by the government, possibly. They don't represent the people
I
and what we need,
because George. They're quite critical of the government. But of course, everybody in Britain has a right to protest and demonstrate and to actually club people and prove their point about the authoritarianism, about the autocratic way in which the British state is run, is extremely foolish, whatever your point of view.
George, when I look at some of the signs and I see it myself, see, when we say the 99% who are the people, see this 1% at the top.
Mm.
How do we out these people? Because it's not politicians that represent the local people. There's 1%, the shadowy 1% that are in every country. How do we out these people, George? How do we find out who they are? How do we put their names up so that we can actually physically know who they are?
Well, we do our best. Decision? We do our best here on the Mother of All talk shows. It's not... always easy to identify the names and the pack drill, but in the first story we did this evening, I've pointed you at the grey zone where you'll be able to read the names of the people that took your money for selling fake news about the Al-Qaeda and ISIS in Syria. That's the kind of thing we try and do. Derek, thanks for the call. Staying in Scotland, Gerard is in Kilwinning. Lodge number nothing there, Gerard.
No, George, my team won 3-0 today, so I'm a happy
So did mine.
All right. That's good to know.
But Lodge number nothing is in Kilwinning. You knew that, right?
Oh, no. Listen, I know my fiancé's down here. I think we're the only Catholics in the village, quite literally.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Gerard.
George, just very quickly, your poll about who's going to be the president in 2024.
Yeah.
It's going to be a man, George. It's going to be a friend of Jesse Ventura. It's going to be another wrestler, Dwayne The Rock Johnson. Telling you right now, the man's intelligent, the looks, the charisma. Certainly rather have him than Miss Markle anyway.
Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Yep.
I'll look him up. We'll try and interview him, Gerard.
He's a busy man, but I'm sure he'll come on for you, George.
Well, look, that would be quite a contest. Dwayne The Rock against the daughter of Donald Trump. That would be the mother of all presidential bouts.
It'd be a good laugh. I think I know who I would pick to win, though. Anyway, but on the serious front, unfortunately, Mr. Trump, George, has said that, well, like you said, he's not giving up power. Now, I don't like Biden, but I want him to win, but I don't think it's actually going to matter now. What do you think is actually going to happen? I know you talked a few weeks ago about...
I think it'll go to the court, Gerard. And I think depending on how obvious it is, if the Democrats have really obviously won, you'll probably get a defection or two on the Supreme Court from the normally reliable right-wing Republican appointees. But if it's close in any way, if they can in any way, they'll give it to Trump, and then there'll be the mother of all battles breaks out across the U.S.
People have actually now been talking, some jokingly, but some seriously, about a second American Civil War. Now, I don't think it's going to get to that stage, but I think we are in a position, there are extremists on both sides. You see them on the streets, the MAGA supporters with their machine guns. But then you do have the Antifa people as well. You know, there are extremists on the left as well.
It will be a first American guerrilla civil war. It will not be pitched armies fighting each other at Gettysburg, one lot in blue and the other lot in red. It wouldn't happen that way. But you could have effectively a mass outbreak of guerrilla violence, terrorism, and all kinds of horrors. I pray that doesn't happen, because I love America. I love American people. I pray that doesn't happen, but it could.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, Israel, is that, to take a cynical look, if I was the Russians or the Chinese, I would be doing my best to make sure that happens, because that would stop, you know, the American military killing me. I'm not just looking at it from a purely cynical point of view, but that's what I was the Russians and the Chinese trying to do my sort of, secret agent style work to well, make sure...
Well, I can't speak for them, obviously, but Putin this week offered cast iron guarantees, a treaty effectively, that neither country would interfere in the internal political life of the other.
Right.
And that was a pretty good offer, I thought. It's been dismissed out of hand in the United States. Yeah. Gerard, thanks for that call. Raymond is in Dundee, my own hometown. Go ahead, Raymond.
Hello there, George. Hope you're feeling top of the morning.
I'm fine. I'm good. Go ahead.
My question relates to this never-ending issue in Scotland about another independence referendum.
Never-ending, I call it, Raymond.
So do I, George. And in the first never-ending, the no vote won by 2 million votes to 1.6 million.
Yeah.
And my argument is this. Because SNP talk about democratic mandates and they put it in their manifesto every Scottish election saying that if they win the majority of votes, they bring in another referendum. I answer them by saying your democratic mandate better beat 2 million votes because that's where the bar is set. And that was the democratic decision. If you want to reverse it and change it, that's your target. And if you don't beat it, just shut up and drop out.
Brilliant, Raymond. They don't even get 1 million votes, never mind 2 million. Great call and a great plan, actually. I hope the powers that be will take that on board. Let's go to Oakland in California, where Jason is on the line. Go ahead, Jason.
Hey, what's going on, George? Been a while. Great show.
Lovely to hear your voice again, your wonderful dulcet tones. Go ahead.
Thank you, sir. So today, you know, you had Ben Norton. Amazing. I love that guy.
He's amazing. I don't know what age he is, but when he's older, I hope he's in the Senate.
Right? Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, talking about, you know, propaganda and, you know, coming, being manufactured and stuff like that. One thing that I was really glad that you finally talked about the whole Uyghur thing. Studied that. I've been reading about that a lot.
It's just it's the biggest hoax since the WMD, and from the same
right?
people.
Well, my whole thing is look, why are there 55 Muslim ethnic Muslim groups in China, right? Yeah. Why are they just attacking the Uyghurs?
Yeah.
You know, obviously it's BS. You know, there's the ETIM, the East Turkmenistan Islamic Movement, you know, and why are they killing
Which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda. The Uyghurs are one of the biggest detachments of Al-Qaeda and ISIS forces in Syria. There's thousands of them.
Yep. And actually, in fact, the terrorists, the attacks in that region have gone to virtually zero.
Yeah, partly because of China's actions, but also partly
exactly.
because they're in Syria, and now they'll be on their way to fight for Azerbaijan.
Well, now I wanted the next thing now that I've been noticing. So my wife is from Thailand, right? And this is hitting home. What I've been noticing what's going on now is a new color revolution. You've got that kid; they call him the Penguin. That's going on out there. What I noticed is the second that Prayut Chan-o-Cha, who is the president, the prime minister right now, started to make stronger connections with China, all of a sudden, you know, there's all this color revolution going on, and it says NED all over it. I've been doing a lot of research.
You have, I can tell. Jason, thanks for a wonderful call. Robert is in Tennessee, who loves England. What's not to love, Robert? Go ahead.
Hello, George. It's good to hear you. I discovered you today, earlier.
How wonderful. And, lovely. I like new viewers, new listeners.
What did you say there?
I'm always delighted at new people coming to the university of the airwaves.
Oh, that's right. Yes. Well, I'll start listening now that I know where you are and how I can get you on.
Excellent.
But I just wanted to mention that things are bad all over. We have a moron for a president, and things are really going downhill here.
Yeah, you've got a moron for a president and a corpse running against him.
Well, I don't know about that. Take the lesser of two evils.
No, you see, I don't buy that, Robert, because, first of all, it's highly debatable which is the lesser of the two evils between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, for me. But moreover, if you keep picking the lesser of two evils, everything just gets more and more evil.
Well, I hadn't thought of that, but you're correct.
I happen to
like Joe Biden, and I've seen what Donald Trump has done. We've lost our reputation as world leaders. Admittedly, we should have, because we are not a world leader anymore. We've withdrawn from everything, and he's also fouling up our natural resources over here. That's the least of it.
Robert, only because of the hour, I have to bring our conversation to a close, but I do hope you'll call back again. I just love your accent apart from anything else. That's Robert in Tennessee. But the main thing is that I have to clear the decks because there's a legend on the line. It's Norma in Bristol. She's back. Go ahead, Norma.
Hello, George.
People have been so worried about you, my dear.
Oh, come on. No, well, to be honest, I have been a bit up and down this week, but I've been watching the tennis tonight as well as your program.
Is that the French Open?
Yeah. Yeah. We lost all the British players, the best ones. They're all gone.
Murray was easily defeated, yeah?
Yes, very contrary, Dan Evans. They've all gone. Anyway,
there's been no tennis since McEnroe and Connors.
Yeah, but that's a long time ago.
And Ili Nastasi and that era. That was tennis. Now it's just, it's a ball being fired like a bullet.
It's all right. I like it.
Yeah?
I like it.
All right.
Anyway, George, it's been a little bit complicated tonight for me. I got a bit stumped with Max Kaiser and his bitcoins and Ben Norton. I was listening and got lost a bit with that. So I think I would bring up a lighter subject.
Yes, go ahead.
And actually, I watched this film, which was called Amazing Grace, which was about William Wilberforce.
Okay.
And the abolition of slavery.
Yeah.
And, it was a good film. It was ever so well done. And that brought me to think, well, I expect people know, but in Bristol, our Colston Hall, the music hall, has now got a lovely new name, and it's called the Beacon Hall, which apparently they say it's a beacon of light for the future for everybody
now,
to enjoy.
Now, was that controversial, just for people who don't know? Colston was a slave trader. It was his statue that ended up in the drink in the harbour, which was a remarkable piece of political theatre. And then they fished the statue out of the drink and they were going to be consulting people. So has this been a controversial move? Because, of course, his name is on all kinds of things, on the square, on the theatre and so on. But now they've changed it, you say.
Well, yeah, no, they were talking about it actually before that statue was pulled down because some people wouldn't go to the Colston or some people wouldn't even perform there because of the name.
Really?
And it's been 3.5 years and I thought Beacon Hall is quite a nice name. It's a beacon of light for the future and, you know...
That's a very beautiful idea. Was there a vote held or was it the local council that decided...
No, it was the lady that was in charge of the whole of the music hall.
She had the power to rename it.
She did. No, they did loads and loads of... they asked people what they thought, this, that and the other. But I think she came down with the final name.
Okay.
But the other thing, quick. It is Mordecai Vanunu's day on Friday this week. You know, the man that was the... revealed the nuclear weapons for Israel.
Indeed, yes.
Yeah.
He is, because he's still alive, although not allowed to travel, one of the bravest and most important men in recent history.
Yes,
he came to London. He tried to get the Daily Mirror, then owned by Robert Maxwell, to publish his story, including his diagrams and drawings and photographs. Yes. And the proprietor of the Daily Mirror, the father of Ghislaine Maxwell, betrayed his whereabouts to the Israeli intelligence agency Mossad. And though the story was eventually run by my friend Andrew Neil in the Sunday Times, it didn't have the same impact it would have had in the then Daily Mirror. And not long afterwards, Mordechai Vanunu was kidnapped in a honey trap by a woman called Cindy in Leicester Square and ended up on trial with his jaws wired together, Norma, so that he couldn't speak, like the silence of the lambs, and then sentenced to what became 17 years in solitary confinement. I'm glad you brought that up, Norma. I didn't realize that that was his birthday on Friday, and we should all wish him the very happiest of birthdays. And may this year have been his last year in the kind of captivity and restrictions in which he is held. Norma in Bristol is back and sounding on good form. Thank you for that. Kamala Harris, 32. Meghan Markle, 25. She'll be disappointed in that. Ivanka Trump, the daughter of Donald Trump, winning easily, 42 up 1. That's very interesting indeed. Now, last couple of messages. Is Ivanka the daughter or the wife? I always get the name wrong, but definitely his daughter would run, not his wife. His daughter will run, and his wife hates her and will do anything that she can to damage her. Maybe she'll write a book about her. Sam says America will be sick of megalomaniacs by then. That's the spelling of Megan Lomaniac by then. I'm not so sure, Sam. Helena says Elizabeth Warren and Mike Pence. Elizabeth Warren's all dried up, in my opinion. And Stevie says Carol Baskin and Kanye West. Poor Kanye, I think he's beginning to lose the plot. Alan says, I would prefer Mrs. Doubtfire to these choices. And Rob says, sorry, I've done Rob already. Bilal says, George, you've told us that our government is lying to us. So why are they lying about this virus that has killed only 0.01% of the world population? Well, we'll be dealing with all of these subjects again next week. Come back at the same time, same place.